Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Verdi, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, or some kind of morning.
Holiday weekend storm brought some wind, some rain. Of course, that wind can, you know, sometimes add up to some unusual visitors, right? So tell us, nothing right now that you know of, but maybe tomorrow?
No. This is just one of those storms. And, you know, I just feel like these nor'easters keep just parking themselves for multiple days. They just,
yeah, this one was, what, 3 days?
Just like a, like a bad house guest. Like, get out of here.
I feel like
they used to just kind of get on their way, you know, and as a birder, you watch nor'easters here on the Cape, because, and you're thinking about storm-driven birds. You're thinking about seabirds that are right now out in the Gulf of Maine, somewhere where you'd have to get in a boat to go see them. And you're thinking about these northeast winds pushing them down into Cape Cod Bay inside the arm of the Cape. But then, you know, and there are places you can go to see if that's happening, like maybe even Manomet Point in Plymouth, but Corporation Beach in Dennis, and then Sandy Neck in Barnstable, probably most famously, the north-facing Cape Cod Bay beaches where you could see the recently displaced storm-driven birds that are getting blown in by these strong northeast winds. And there's really been nothing, just kind of standard October scoter migration, these big black sea ducks that come down from the Arctic and big skeins, you know, that's starting to happen, but nothing major, no big bunches of Jaegers or shearwaters or phalaropes or any of the kind of things that we hope for in a storm like this, with heavy winds coming in off the Gulf of Maine. But typically you wait for the storm to pass and then the winds switch from northeast to northwest. And then you start thinking about inside elbow of the Cape, like First Encounter Beach in Eastham, most famously. So that beach faces more west. So the birds that got pushed into the bay in the first place are then trying to leave the bay. It's not where they want to be. And so they're hugging the shoreline, trying to avoid flying over land. And then they end up flying right by First Encounter. And that's where some of the most amazing storm-driven seabird flights have happened over the years. And it's an easy, you know, as a birder, you just go in, you could bird from your car. That's another reason it's perfect, right? It's convenient, and it's a place where the birds concentrate. And so, you know, your car might get sandblasted, but, you know, people are go there before sunrise when they know the winds are switching around to the west and jockey for the best spot where they don't have to get out of their car to see birds going by. And it's often terrible viewing conditions, but the hardcore folks get out there. And so tomorrow it looks like finally the winds are going to swing around to the northwest, like not too strong. So I know, you know, birders will go there. There will be birders at First Encounter, maybe other places in that general area around sunrise, I would expect. I'll probably try to shoot over there after the kids get on the bus or somewhere. But it'll be interesting to see if there is anything, because I'm not seeing any evidence that anything has been blown in so far from the few reports I'm seeing from places like Sandy Neck. We'll see.
Okay, and if you are seeing something, give us a call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. You can also shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So talk a little bit about October migration. This is a time of year birders get really excited, right? Because there's all kinds of stuff that they could be seeing.
Yeah, so from my memory, October, if you go into eBird, Cornell's eBird, and you click on Barnstable County, and then you can then click by month and look at the species total by month. And I'm pretty sure October has had the most bird species recorded on Cape Cod of any month. You would think of May, like, oh, the spring migration, yay. But October has seen a lot, quite a few more species recorded than even May. And so, you know, it's just that they're not, they're often kind of subtly plumaged, right? We're thinking about sparrows, confusing fall warblers, like, oh, what does it look like? Well, it's sort of olive and yellow. They all are. And so it doesn't have the flash. It doesn't have the song that goes with spring migration, right? In May, the warblers and buntings and tanagers are all singing and telling you where they are. So it's more of a birder's season, right? It's challenging, but the birds are there and in numbers, and sometimes in very obvious ways you can see the migration. Like I mentioned, the Scoter migration, which is a classic October phenomenon that's underway. It's been mostly white-winged scoters so far, and now the surf scoters are picking up. This is three species of big, mostly shellfish-eating ducks, kind of like common eiders, that come down from, Canada, boreal regions, subarctic and arctic Canada, where they breed, and they come down in big flocks. And you can see scoter migration because it happens during the day. Anytime you get a cold front, you can sometimes high up or sometimes just low over the water, any place on the bay or out by Monomoy, you can see it. Sometimes by Monomoy, they look like smoke. There's so many scoters coming in. It's just a very cool thing. And there are hundreds of thousands of them that will sometimes winter out there, along with up to a half a million common eiders out around and off of Monomoy. But a lot of them are just passing through. And this is when you see that. And just continuing with seabirds, the loons will start to pick up now. And so, under the right conditions, you could see dozens, maybe even hundreds of red-throated loons if they're coming by. And so there, and common loons as well. So we have two species of loons that commonly pass through here and winter here. Of the two, red-throated loon is both the most abundant and the least known. It's kind of a paradox where the average person knows about common loons, right? They see them on the lakes and right. But red-throated loon's an Arctic nesting loon that, if you added up all of the loons that are on the Cape over the course of a year, there are more red-throated loons that pass through the Cape's waters than common loons.
Is their call similar to the common loon or is it different?
No.
No.
No, they don't make a lot of sound, but they have some kind of yodels, different. They don't have the classic common loon sounds, and you don't hear them as much. Common loons can be vocal any time of year, like a foggy day, just about any time of year. If there's a common loon around, you might hear them give that old on Golden Pond kind of
Love
call.
that. I know it's so,
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I
I don't
heard
think
it
I've
in
ever heard one
something.
here though. I mean they will call even in our area or
We were watching, what were we watching last night? Lilo and Stitch, which takes place in Hawaii, and they're playing common loon calls in the background. I'm like, there are no common loons in Hawaii. Come on. But you hear them in movies, even in the wrong places, because it's
Yeah.
such a cool sound.
It is a cool sound, yeah.
So I missed your question because I was thinking about
No,
Lilo
I
and
was just
Stitch.
saying I don't ever think I've I mean I certainly haven't seen a common loon. I know they go through, but do they call when they're here? I've never heard that here. I mean, I've heard it in New Hampshire, but not. Oh, listen to that. Maybe I just haven't been paying attention enough. I don't
Well,
know.
you weren't paying attention to me because I just, it's what I just said. I know you tuned me out. My wife does the same thing.
No, I was actually
It,
reading
it's,
an
it's,
email
it's
though.
understand, it's understandable. Well, no, I was just saying that you can hear them here
Any
any
time of
time
year.
of
Yeah,
year.
but I've never heard them though.
Nobody listens to me, even you, for crying out
No, I
loud.
heard you say that. I just but I've still even
I
if
know.
they call, I've never heard it. Yeah.
Just giving you a hard time. You know how I am. I'm always like, what? Where's the caller from? I'm always thinking about something else.
Right, so what about songbirds? What about the songbird migration? I mean,
Oh yeah, it finally got good. Over the last couple of weeks, there were some genuine little fallouts, where warblers and some of the first sparrows were just really in evidence. Having come down from the Canadian Maritimes and other parts of Canada, I had the experience the other day where I don't know what date was it, Friday? I put the kids on the bus. It's like 7 a.m. I come back and I'm standing on my deck and I hear a little chip note that I recognize as coming from a black-throated green warbler, which is just a migrant here. They don't breed on the Cape. That's just one of the many migrant warblers that come through here that birders love to see. I was like, oh, black-throated green, cool. And I'm standing on my deck, and my deck is like, it's almost like a treehouse because it's sort of enveloped by this oak that I refuse to prune because I love that treehouse effect. And so many times I have been standing on my deck and a warbler is almost arm's reach away, a Blackburnian warbler in spring. So I'll be damned if I'm going to prune back that oak. You know, other people cut them down. I don't like the caterpillar poop, but I'm like, I want to be like in the tree.
Yeah.
And so I look up and within, you know, 8 feet of me was the black-throated green warbler, a Nashville warbler, a blackpoll warbler.
Wow.
And there's one other kind too. I can't, but they were four species warblers. And I'm, you know, I'm just standing on my deck and they're all in like one part of one tree. And I'm like, oh, it's a fallout morning. And, you know, there were some other things around, like my neighbor's yard, it was an American red starred and something else. And so I popped down to Monomoy, Morris Island real quick, which can be great in the fall. It's a great fall fallout spot, but it was completely different. I wasn't seeing any warblers. There was a fallout of kinglets, golden crowned and ruby crowned kinglets. Those are very much October migrants that everybody should be listening and watching for. You know, you might need Merlin, be running Merlin sound ID to help you with that, with the kinglets. Creepers were in abundance there, and that's another fall migrant, brown creepers, the little tiny bark, basically moving pieces of bark. And so they had obviously migrated in. There were a bunch of white-throated sparrows. That's another really common October migrant. So we're transitioning from, you know, the September, late summer migration of warblers and tanagers and things. And October is more like...
Ooh, Dan's on it this morning, huh?
Dan, look at that.
Yeah. Yes. Pine warbler.
Mm-hmm. I was like, geez, that wasn't one I mentioned. But yeah, I did have a pine warbler that day in my neighbor's yard. Yeah, they're around. And so, you know, they were just... And then... When I was with a group up at High Head and got to see this really cool migration that was very recent and ongoing, where birds that had come down across the Gulf of Maine very clearly and then had dropped into the thickets were High Head is a great place to see this. It's high, believe it or not, Mindy. It's the last kind of high spot before you get to P-Town. And it butts right up against Pilgrim Lake, as we used to call it, or East Harbor now, that big body of water as you're on Route 6 heading into P-Town. And so birds are kind of like moving west. They don't want to be over the water anymore. They're trying to get back and reorient over the mainland to continue their migration. And so they're moving west through the thickets or sometimes up high, giving little calls. And so it was just very cool to see this. There are all these warblers and some sparrows, vireos, just all around us, up high, calling, heading west. And that's, I think, how they often end up in the beech forest, that famous forest of beech trees in the Cape Cod National Seashore in P-Town, where birders go, particularly in May. But I think that's how they end up there. They're moving west through Truro and across High Head, and then they fly across Pilgrim Lake, East Harbor, and then they end up in the beech forest because it's good-looking habitat. And so it was just cool to see this in action, right? Mm-hmm. These were birds that had been over the Gulf of Maine 20 minutes ago,
wow.
Right? And
yeah.
That were dropping in and trying to figure out where to go. Do they feed? Do they keep going? And, you know, you don't always get to see that on the Cape. And so...
Yeah. Be in the right place at the right time, right?
Yeah. Right place at the right time. But yeah, so we're getting into the season to hang out and as it cools down, like sunny places, sunny... community gardens tend to be good. Any kind of place where the sun is hitting some edge between habitats, like where a forest butts up against a marsh or a weedy field or something like that, where the sun is hitting it in the morning, like check those places for migrants, you know, as we're getting more cold fronts and cooler weather. And, you know, sparrows, there are some lingering warblers and tanagers and even cuckoos, like there was a black-billed cuckoo at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary the other day. That's something that happens in October. October can just be a great time to see continued songbird migration, especially after a cold front passes. Yeah.
All right, Tor's giving us a call from Truro. Hi, Tor.
Yeah, hi, Mindy. I have 2 points briefly. One was, Mark, good morning. You mentioned blackpoll warbler on your deck. When I lived in Mount Greylock area in North Adams, there's a plaque. When you get to the top of the mountain and you walk around the trails, there's an actual plaque that says the only nesting site in all of Massachusetts for the black pole warbler is right there on Mount Greylock. And
That's
here's
right.
number two, the eider ducks. The eider ducks that you say are very numerous is such a recovery if it's true. Because here, when I was living at my old house in Truro, I was able to watch and document the many flying sea ducks, including mergansers as well as eiders. So there were good supply then. That was 70s and 80s. Now, in more recent years, Dr. Corshane, I think out of Tufts, would document a search and find so many dead eiders on the shore, perhaps consumed either by starvation or by a certain virus that was killing them in big numbers. They would wash ashore on Great Island. And just to be brief, I want to know if you think that this recovery is meaning that they're less affected by the paucity of shellfish and maybe the absence or turning point away from a killing virus.
Tor, thanks for the question.
For the black pole warblers, we're expecting them to. And I haven't checked on the current status, but it's true. They only breed on this one little bit of stunted spruce fir forest. It's like a little bit of the boreal forest on the top of Mount Greylock. And we're fully expecting them to not be able to breed there anymore because that's with climate change, things are kind of having to move up in elevation and then they run out of room. And so they'll probably be gone. I don't know about any a recovery of the sea ducks or positive change in the population, but he was talking about this what's called the Wellfleet Bay virus that affects common eiders. And yes, Great Island in Wellfleet has been the epicenter of that, where it's been most evident. And it was a mystery for many years, you know, and they were looking at parasites, the thorny-headed worm, is it starvation? And then some. You know, one of the kind of people that are all losing their jobs now, somebody in a federal lab who studies wildlife diseases, kind of working overtime, isolated this virus that this novel virus that had never been seen, related to some tick-borne viruses. And that's where it stands, as far as I know. Nobody knows how the eiders get this virus that is related to tick-borne viruses. Nobody's really finding ticks on the eiders. The people in really concerted effort to find if there are ticks on them and studying them on the nests and things like that. And so it's a little bit of a mystery how they get this virus, but it still results in a certain number of dead eiders every year. And sometimes you see them kind of standing around moribund, particularly on Great Island there in Wellfleet, whatever reason. And it picks up now during fall sea duck migration.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got a couple of emails, Mark. Malcolm in Provincetown says, I'm certainly not a meteorologist, but I think this is not technically a nor'easter as it didn't come in from the northeast. It's a coastal system that worked its way up from the south and brought us northeast winds. Perhaps that is why you are not seeing so many birds dragged down from the north? All right, Malcolm, thanks. I don't know. I thought I heard meteorologists saying it was a nor'easter, but I don't know.
It's definitely a nor'easter. It's
Okay.
what they all do. I don't
Yeah.
know. I'm not sure what that
Okay.
means. Yeah.
All right. Then we got Joe in West Harwich says, I've lived in a residential neighborhood in West Harwich for 25 years. This summer, a murder of crows numbering around 15 to 20 has been roaming my neighborhood, often landing on my roof and in my yard. The racket they make is astonishing. Unfortunately, they often visit my home around 5:30 a.m., and they serve as an unwanted avian alarm clock. The range and variety of their loud calls are amazing. I know that crows are highly intelligent and are said to have the IQ of a 5-year-old. Has anyone studied what their varying calls mean? And is there any chance that there's an app that I could use to tell them to stop squawking at my house so early in the morning? Also, I found a few swallows staging for my migration near Sisuet Harbor last Saturday. Loved the show, and he attached a photo, which I sent to you, Mark. But Yeah, it's crows. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes it seems like they're mocking you, right?
Yeah, right. They are really smart, and then you don't want to have a crow roost in your yard necessarily if you like sleeping. But sometimes you end up with one, or sometimes a pre-roost where they come in. Like that's not so bad when they come in the evening and they make a racket. Like that's okay.
Then they move
But
on, yeah.
when they stay there and then they wake up really early, like it's hard to put your pillow over your head and go back to sleep
Yep.
with that racket. But yeah, they do roost in sometimes big numbers, and they're a huge crow roost. Like be thankful you don't live in one of the giant crow roosts that are often in cities. Lawrence, Mass has a very famous one where you get American crows, some fish crows that some do stay the winter, and it's like thousands and thousands of them. And yes, they're very smart. Smart as a 5-year-old. Huh. I wonder. And how do they know that? Can they read? My 5-year-old daughter starting to read. I don't know. But what were the other tree swallows? Yeah, the tree swallows had mostly gone, and then I just wasn't seeing the swarms anymore. And then, especially towards the latter half of last week, I was seeing them again. And this gives me a chance to share another story. I can
Go,
just talk.
yes,
It's so
no,
nice. I
these
can just
good
talk about
stories, Mark. Go ahead.
bird stuff I see.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky. People are sitting there listening for some reason. But where was I? I was at a beach in Brewster, and oftentimes I'm going to these beaches looking for fish now, and birds, see if there's any opportunity to do some fishing. But as I was standing there, tree swallows came in, and they clearly were like new arrivals because I watched them come in high off the bay. They weren't just like locals kind of moving through the dunes. They came in high, and I got to watch them just descend like snowflakes. It was like a blizzard of tree swallows. It was so cool. It's just one of those things in fall migration that you don't get to see very often, but it's these kinds of things are happening all the time around us if you're in the right place at the right time. And there were some people there, and and of course they're filming it with their phone, and I was doing the same thing, but they just all descended, and there were like 2,000 of them, high hundreds anyway. I have to go back and look at my estimates, but just swirling larger numbers of birds than you typically see in a given day. And all around us, and they were descending on the bayberries, which
Yeah.
is one of the things they do this time of year, because tree swallows eat those ridiculous waxy little candly fruits on bayberries. They're one of a handful of species of birds that can eat those. And it's the only fruit they eat for some reason, as far as I know. They mostly eat flying insects, and so they're all like, there's like 200 of them all on one little bayberry shrub, and they're kind of cycling through and they're hovering over it, and then they all get up at once and kind of like it's like a murmurations. They circle overhead and then they go back down on the bush, all happening like within 50 feet of me. It's just so cool to see. It's just
Yeah.
one of those late summer fall phenomena that we have so many cool ones here that we can enjoy in coastal Massachusetts, and especially here on the Cape.
All right. So, also, tell us a little bit about this mystery kingbird at Gray Beach in Yarmouth.
Yeah, gray kingbird at Gray's Beach. As far as we could tell, it was one of these things. It's a local birder who's pretty experienced. I think it was the person I'm thinking of, and they put it on. There's like a Facebook group that's basically continent wide. I don't know if it was What's This Bird or Advanced Birding. There are different ones that basically the audience is the entire continent. And people will put up puzzling birds, and experts will weigh in. This was like Gray's Beach in Yarmouth. Like, oh, I know where that is. And it looked like a gray kingbird. And someone else was like, well, maybe it's a thick-billed kingbird. It was kind of a grainy photo, but I'm sure it was a gray kingbird. And no one has found it since. The weather got bad after that. And it this is a Caribbean species that does breed in Florida a little bit, and there have been some records up here, but usually people are able to track something like that down or it'll stick around for a little bit, but unfortunately this was just like a flash on the internet and it just went away and nobody found it again. I think a couple of different people saw it and reported it. But it just went away. And, you win some, you lose some. So that one, no other birders caught up to it. But it's just that time of year, and anywhere you go, you need to be alert and have a something to photograph things ready, whether it's your phone or a real camera, because anything can be anywhere.
You mentioned murmuration, and I wonder if you talk a little bit about that for folks who don't know what that is. This is a time of year we would see that, right?
The murmuration
of anything,
well, right. Yes, fall is when you see big numbers of things in flocks because, like, what a bird's been doing all summer, right? They've been making more birds, and so this is sort of the peak abundance of everything because all the young birds are, most of them are still alive, and so and they're flocking together with the adults, and so there's just an abundance of birds on the landscape, and so the flocking birds are getting into big flocks. A murmuration is a very specific thing that started with starlings in the UK and these sort of viral videos of these incredible giant flocks of starlings, bigger than what we would typically see around here, just in these beautiful shifting waves and patterns, like over a loch in Scotland. Like that's where the kind of the murmuration term and sort of viral videos came from. We don't see tons of things around here that you would call a murmuration. I think further, like on the Connecticut River, down in Connecticut, there are even bigger, like huge tree swallow swarms, where I think you're getting what you could call a murmuration when they're all in the air and these beautiful wave-like shifting flocks. But that's really what it is. We're certainly seeing big flocks. The thing that's been most evident in my neck of the woods, literally, is grackles, like flocks of definitely over 1,000 grackles. Like my son and I were fishing in Nickerson State Park the other evening, and he was helping me count them. He's like, "Dad, another 100 went by." But there was like, 2,000 grackles went by in the span of 20 minutes, like heading to roost somewhere. And then at my house, they'll go through the oak woods. They're looking for acorns and whatever else. And they come through just like 2,000 grackles, like a marauding horde will come through, at tree level through the trees and just making a cacophony. So that's something that happens starting in late summer through now, where you get like big numbers of birds. They don't really, I don't know if they really form murmurations, but the cool thing when they start doing some of those more interesting group flight patterns is when there's a hawk after them. And so that's, and so when you see a sudden change in the behavior of a flock of birds where all of a sudden they like go quiet and ball up, the flock gets tighter, there's a falcon or a Cooper's hawk, like just look.
They don't want to be on the
And you'll,
outside.
yeah. And so, right, it's a defensive maneuver. And so, yeah, look for that. Look for a sudden change in the behavior of a flock, or if they all go quiet. And then, look for that Cooper's hawk or peregrine falcon, merlin, whatever it is. Those are the three most likely things.
Right. Let's talk to Sarah, giving us a call from East Sandwich. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. Mark and Mindy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I overlook Squirtin Creek, the lower Squirtin Creek, and this morning there has been what appears to be, to me, a battalion of cormorants swimming up the creek and then flying back down again and then coming back. And I think the tide is going out, and I'm thinking there may be small fish. Coming upstream. And very often, when the tide is completely out and there's a sandbar exposed on the far side of the creek, there will be a cluster of gulls on the sandbar and the cormorants in the water. And I'm assuming the cormorants are sort of driving small fish toward the sandbar, and maybe the gulls are getting some, but I'm just curious about all of this behavior.
Yeah, that is what's happening. And so, the cormorants, right? So much of what a lot of us birders and especially people who fish are looking at right now is what's going on with bait fish and who's eating the bait fish and where are they and what are the bait fish doing. And so if you're fishing, you're looking for birds over, you know, feeding striped bass. And so the gulls benefit from the striped bass pushing the bait fish to the surface. And then, like I was able to catch a striper. There were some laughing gulls working off Skakit Beach one morning. And, you know, I just within 20 minutes or last 10 minutes, I had a striper. And so, we're looking for that for fishing reasons. But the cormorants function kind of like the fish, right? Because they get underwater. The gulls can't and the terns can't. And so the cormorants can drive the bait fish around and maybe drive them to the surface in a way that the gulls can benefit from. But yeah, everybody's working small bait fish, herring coming out of the various herring runs, juvenile herring, menhaden, the little menhaden they call peanut bunker. On the Sound side in particular, they're huge schools of bay anchovies. People realize we have anchovies around here, but bay anchovies are one of the important bait fish for birds and false albacore and striped bass and everything. And so all of that is coming together right now. And you know, if you want a fish, you're looking for the birds, and if you want a bird, you're looking for the birds, and they're all eating bait fish. But yeah, laughing gulls, probably people have been fishing for decades who don't know what a laughing gull is, but they sure know to look for birds to tell them where to fish. They may not necessarily know where they are, but it's typically laughing gulls at this time of year before they leave for the winter that are feeding over these striped bass blitzes, bait fish blitzes. But when it's in the like an outgoing tide and it's really shallow, usually it's just bait and not mm-hmm. the bigger fish, and the cormorants are moving them around and gulls are benefiting from it. Yep. Yeah.
Sarah, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Mark, this is like, I feel like a drum roll, the big news, right? The big news of this month, the trio of rare bar-tailed godwits. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Plymouth. You know, we don't talk about Plymouth that much. It's like sort of just skirting the listening area there. Rare shorebirds have always been a staple of late summer, you know, mostly late summer here on the Cape. But we can't, the places we used to get all those rare shorebirds are sort of either gone or inaccessible, mostly around Chatham. South Beach is pretty well gone now, hard to get out to. They're not running tours out there anymore. And that's where people would find things like bar-tailed godwits, redneck stints, curlew sandpipers, these basically Eurasian, very rare for here sandpipers that birders would hope to find. So here's Plymouth Beach picking up the slack. Plymouth Beach is an excellent shorebirding spot. It's just a little difficult. It's, you know, you can drive out to a certain point, but then you have to walk and it's very long. But yeah, these three bar-tailed godwits, which is, it's got to be unprecedented. I'd have to look back. You know, typically you get one. One would be a lot, right? One bar-tailed godwit is way more than you would expect, which is zero bar-tailed godwits. But three was almost surreal. And they were hanging out there on Plymouth Beach for several days, and all the birders were going down there and as we do now, reporting on it in real time and various apps. And I was talking to some really long-time birder who was out there trying to show it to people. And they were like, they must have been new birders, and they're like looking at their phones and seeing that somebody said they're not there. And so he's like, well, they just flew in and they're right there. And they're like, no, it's not, they're not here. They're looking at, they're believing what their
they're
phone.
Seeing on their phone, yeah.
And he's like, no, it's just look, it's literally right there. And they're like, no, they said it's gone. It was just this surreal experience where new birders who are so dependent on their phones and what their phones are telling them that they can't even look to see the bird that's right there. But that's things are changing. But yeah, so this is just one of the most amazing creatures. I mean, never mind birds, one of the most amazing living things. And bar-tailed godwits breed in the Arctic, including Arctic, Alaska, and, Siberia. And they have a well-known migration where they fly from there to New Zealand. And so I don't suppose anybody has a globe handy. You can you can bring up Google Earth or whatever and kind of spin the virtual globe. But, I made sure my kids have a real old-fashioned physical globe, and we look at it. I loved having one as a kid. But you can spin it. So basically Hawaii is in the middle, and you're looking at the Pacific Ocean. You can see there's no land anywhere. It's just that part of the globe where it's just ocean, 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 ocean. And that's what they cross. They have to cross that to go from Alaska to New Zealand for some reasons known only to them in their evolutionary history. This makes sense to them to do that perilous flight. And they're not a gull or a duck. They can't land on the water and kind of hang out when they get tired. They don't have webbed feet. They would die if they tried to land on the water. So they have to keep flying, and maybe they would land in the Hawaiian Islands sometimes, but a lot of them, they do it nonstop. They put tracking devices on them. And it is just astounding. It is an absolutely astounding feat of migration that might be the greatest of all birds. Arctic terns were always touted as having the longest migration, but an Arctic tern, can land on the water. It's a seabird. Mm-hmm. This is a land bird crossing the biggest part of the Pacific Ocean to get to the other end of the planet. And so there's a wow factor that comes with a bar-tailed godwit beyond the fact that it's just an incredibly rare bird that shouldn't be here. And godwits just themselves are just amazing. It's just, we see little sanderlings and other small sandpipers and plovers, but this is a big sandpiper with a big, long, crazy bill designed to get down at those worms that are a little deeper in and shellfish that are deeper in. And so they're just a really cool looking bird in addition to all of the other stuff that goes with them, the rarity, the incredible migration. It's not the first time there's been one in Plymouth. I remember one from like close to 25 years ago, I want to say, that was found on a Christmas bird count in Plymouth in December. But still, that's just a very cool bird. It's good to have a rare shorebird. That was always such a staple. And I feel like we don't get as many anymore because people aren't able to get out to those parts of Chatham as much. It's mostly researchers who are getting out there. And
so we may be still getting them. We're just not seeing them. Yeah.
Well, right. Maybe they're out there and right. It's just harder to find them now because not as many people are going out there. But
so now these birds are supposed to be going to New Zealand. Will they still go to New Zealand from here?
Well, no, it's more complicated than that. So that's the ones that breed in that part of the Arctic go to New Zealand. But this is a European one could have wintered in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And so like a lot of these Arctic nesting shorebirds, there are different subpopulations that do different things in the winter, like red knots. Like some red knots might winter at Monomoy, while those Rufa subspecies red knots go to Tierra del Fuego at the other end of South America. Mm-hmm. Why?
Don't know.
Who knows? Yeah. It's bizarre. Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre. But the bar-tailed godwit is like that. And so there's a European nesting population that some go to West Africa, and some go to Western Europe. This is likely one of those. And so it's not like, oh boy, I got to get to New Zealand. Anybody?
I need directions.
Point the way. Yeah.
All right. Linda's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello.
I'm curious. I mean, I can Google this and I'm sure it's obvious to birders, but I am wondering why some of these, particularly some of the small birds you've just discussed, go all the way to these very northern, inhospitable places to breed. What is it about breeding? You would think trying to raise young and breeding in these very inhospitable, frigid places would just be an anathema. And instead, we see this cycle, and I'm mystified as to why they want to breed in the north, only to travel all the way back to some other far distant locale.
Yeah, right. I wonder the same thing, and many, many others before us, too. You know, it's hard to prove. The simple answer is really, you know, they're taking advantage of a huge flush of resources in terms of insects. It's short, right? It's a short window, and you've got to hit it right. And these shorebirds that are going back to nest in the high Arctic tundra, you know, it's snowing on them when they're initiating their breeding season. And so, and they really just, they have one go at it, right? Because it's really just the month of June, maybe a little bit into July, and then they have to be done. Because, you know, winter starts knocking on the door pretty early up there. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it is mystifying, and not everything's going to the Arctic, but it's especially mysterious with those things that go all the way up to the Arctic, like most of the sandpipers and plovers that go up there. And then, you know, and then in some cases go to the, completely to the other end of the planet. And you're just like, really? You can't find worms and clams anywhere else without flying? Got to be such a risky flight, right? Like all the exposure to predators and storms, right? The longer you go. But somehow it works out for them. And it has evolved to be a stable thing that makes sense for them and maintains the population over time, where, you know, births and deaths are balanced out. Mm. And it works for them. And that's ultimately what it comes down to.
I mean, you know, we think of them like, you look like a little plover, you think of them as being fragile. Same thing, we talk about the hummingbirds all the time. These birds are a lot tougher than we think they are. I mean, really, when you think about what they go through.
Right. And we're always thinking of things from our perspective, you know, and they're just so different than mm-hmm. us. They see differently. They experience the world differently. They can sense things we can't sense. They can survive things we could never survive. They have different physiologies. They have different ways of dealing with the cold, different circulatory systems, different hearts. Right. So everything about them is built for them to do their job. Right. That's their job. And we are sitting inside our cozy house looking out at the cold, and we're thinking about them like they're us or like they're our kids or something. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, the birds, they must be so cold. How are they doing it? Well, that's their job, yeah. Right? They're yeah. built for that. Their bodies are different. Their brains are different. They can find, you know, we don't see insects in the winter. Like, we're not looking around, but they do. Mm-hmm. They know, like, chickadees can find caterpillars exposed on tree bark in January.
That's crazy,
right? If they couldn't, they wouldn't be here. You know, they would have mm-hmm. migrated. And so it's just a constant sense of awe looking right. at what
amazing.
They're able to
it's
do.
Amazing little creatures. Linda, thanks for the call. All right, so bird feeder season. A lot of folks are putting out their bird feeders now. So this is another good time of year. You never know what's going to land on that feeder, right?
Yes. And I benefited from somebody else who had to shut down their operation because of rats. This was just one of our volunteers brought in some of the good stuff that I don't normally shell out the money for the shell-less sunflower seed, you know, the hulled sunflower seed, the hearts. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if maybe I'm missing out on something because it seems to last longer. But anyway, somebody gave me some of theirs, and so I've been putting that stuff out. And that stuff can be a rarity magnet, I know, if you get the sunflower hearts. Often somebody in the winter who ends up with something interesting like a Western tanager or something like that, it's often somebody who's feeding the good stuff, the mm-hmm. the sunflower hearts. How am I doing, Mike? but anyway, it's that stuff works really well. But yes, this is the best time to make sure if you're feeding birds, you're still doing that. Good, I am, and this is when interesting things might be turning up, and so you want to be stocked up. I even, you know, keep those hummingbird feeders out like we talk about all the time. They're gone. I didn't get an October sighting of a ruby-throated hummingbird like I often do. I'll often get my last sighting of a hummingbird in the first few days of October. But I wasn't seeing them much the last week of September even. And so, you know, they're gone. But But now if a hummingbird turns up, it's going to be like a rufous hummingbird from the west, or one of the even more rare ones. And so I do like to keep mine out. You know, you still have to keep them clean, but it's much easier, right? It's not warm. You don't have to clean them every few days. Mostly seed, you know, it's maybe time to start thinking about suet. Keep the bird baths filled. I guess that's not so important right now, is it?
Right.
We live once, in a world of puddles today.
and keep that camera or phone ready, because
absolutely.
Nobody's going to believe you, right? And then you're going to have that phone and go, see, it really, really was a, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And then you can think about, like, if you're a dedicated feeder watcher, you can think about doing Project Feeder Watch, which is a Cornell project, where you commit to doing, I think, 2 1-hour sessions a week. I think they want them to be back-to-back days, ideally. But you can go to the Project Feeder Watch site, and it's one of the few things where they do collect money. Like, most of the stuff, all these citizen science projects that Cornell has are free, like eBird, but I think Project Feeder Watch, they make you pay like $15 or something like that. But it's a cool thing to do, especially if you are a dedicated feeder watcher and you have lots of feeders, and you can contribute data. And, you know, there's been published research using this. You wouldn't think of like feeder data as being kind of legitimate biological data, but it certainly is.
Yeah.
You know, you're concentrating birds, and you can see trends in things like, you know, what's happening with evening grosbeaks, for example, or what's happening with house finch conjunctivitis, right? Mm-hmm. Diseases can be evident sometimes. And so it does actually generate real data that supports research.
Yeah. And don't feel bad if you can't put out feeders because of rats like me. It's been, I don't know, 7 maybe years since I pulled down my feeders. I still have them in my yard. I still have lots of little places that they can feed on things in my garden. And I still see pretty much the same birds I used to see on my feeders. Are just scattered about the yard. So you just have to look a little harder.
Right. And if you do have to get rid of them for some reason, homeowners association, whatever, various reasons, you've tried everything else and you still have the rats, like you've secured your compost and other food and water sources. Like, once I secured my compost, that was it. And I don't see rats anymore. And I'm still able to feed the birds. No
problem. I have nothing and I see rats.
Right. And it's
in the neighborhood, right? What are you
it's
do?
So neighborhood dependent, and, you know, trash and things like that. I mean, I'm surprised that I have been, like, knock on wood, the compost somehow did it. And there's two people very close to me who have backyard chickens. So I would think our whole neighborhood would be awash in rats, but I don't see them so much. And the compost seem to take care of it. But
I will say, in the winter, if you have the bird baths out, I have the bird baths, and I get lots of birds in the bird's bath. You know, when obviously now there's plenty of water, but when there's no water, bird bath.
Yeah. Heated bird bath. Birds do like it. They don't need as much water as you think in the winter. They barely need any. They get most of their water from the food they eat. I think we sort of overestimate how much they need water in the winter, but a heated bird bath will attract a flock of bluebirds, or, you know, it'll attract things that you wouldn't otherwise get.
That's worth it. Yeah, so, for sure.
Yeah, they're absolutely worth it. Yeah.
All right. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Let's catch you next time.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.